Today, I will explain to you the four foundations of mindfulness in brief. You have been practicing foundations of mindfulness for a long time, and so you need to know the four foundations. Now, in order for you to remember the four foundations, I have you recite this passage every morning after taking the precepts. I have explained this passage here many times, and so for many people it may be what they already know. But there are new people also, and so it will be good to give the explanation of this first passage from the discourse called The Great Discourse on the Foundations of Mindfulness. This passage in the discourse explains the four foundations of mindfulness in brief. Now, the word translated as foundation of mindfulness is satipatthana. And satipatthana is defined and explained in the commentary as the mindfulness which is firmly established. Mindfulness which goes to the object with force, so which rushes to the object and then covering the object and being well established. So that is what is called satipatthana, or the foundations of mindfulness. So actually, foundation of mindfulness means mindfulness which is founded, which is firmly established. The characteristic of mindfulness is described as not wobbling, that means not floating on the surface. So the mindfulness must go deep into the object, not just float on the object. The commentaries explain that mindfulness must be not like a ball or something that floats on the object, but it must go deep into the object, it must sink into the object as a rock sinks into the water. So when we practice mindfulness, we try to establish a firmly on the object of our choice and also on the objects that become prominent at the present moment. Buddha began with the words, "This is the only way, bhikkhus," and so on. So in these words, there is a word bhikkhu. Now, bhikkhu is translated as monk, but bhikkhu has more meaning than a monk. Now, the word bhikkhu normally means one who begs. So those who beg are called bhikkhus. But the monks do not beg like the beggars do. So when the monks beg, they just stand at the door saying nothing. And then lay people will come out of the houses and offer something to them, or sometimes they may be asked to pass on. So they did not say anything, but they accept what is given to them. And that is called the Aryan begging or noble begging. There is another meaning of the word bhikkhu, and that is one who sees danger in the round of rebirths. So according to that definition, not only monks, but also lay people who see danger in the round of rebirths can be called bhikkhus. That is why I use the word bhikkhus rather than monks here. Because if you use the word monk for the Pali word bhikkhu, some people may think that this discourse is for monks only. But when we have the word bhikkhu without translation, then we can say that this sutta or this discourse is not for monks only, but for all those who see danger in the round of rebirth. The reason why bhikkhus or monks are always addressed by the Buddha was that Buddha lived in a monastery and he lived with monks. So whenever he wanted to give a talk, he addressed the monks naturally. There may be some lay people, but the monks are the principal receivers of his teachings. And so the Buddha always used the word bhikkhu, or when he wanted to call them bhikkhave. And according to the commentary, many lay people in that area where this discourse was given, and that is called the Kingdom of Kuru. It is somewhere near modern Delhi. So the commentary explains that many lay people also practice the four foundations of mindfulness. If they meet together and ask, what foundation of mindfulness are you practicing? And if a person answers, no, I practice nothing, then he is scolded. So when somebody says that I practice the contemplation on the body or on the feelings, then they would praise him. So according to that explanation, many lay people also practiced the foundations of mindfulness. In this sentence, Buddha said, this is the only way. Now, the Pali word for this is ekayano. Now, this word ekayano has meanings other than the only way. But I liked this explanation, and so I retain the word the only way. Now, there are many people who do not want Buddha to say this is the only way. So according to them, there must be other ways also to reach Nibbana. But through practice, we can prove that the translation, the only way, is a correct translation of the Pali word ekayano, and it is preferable to other translations. Because so long as you have mindfulness, so long as mindfulness is standing as a guard at the doors of the eyes, ears, and so on, no undesirable, unwholesome mental states can enter your mind. So long as there is mindfulness, they cannot enter your mind, and so mindfulness is the only way to prevent them from entering your mind and making your mind contaminated, or in other words, to purify your mind. So the translation, the only way, is, I think, preferable here. In the Dhammapada, Buddha said more explicitly. So there he said, this alone is the way and there is no other. So following that statement in the Dhammapada, the translation of the word ekayana as the only way is according to the wishes of the Buddha. If it is to purify the mind, it must be mindfulness. But mindfulness can be practiced in many ways. Even in the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness itself, Buddha taught 21 different ways of practicing mindfulness. So mindfulness can take many forms, but whatever form it takes, it must be mindfulness, and it must not be otherwise. That is why mindfulness is said to be the only way. At outset, at the beginning of this discourse, Buddha gave us five benefits that we can get from the practice of mindfulness. The first is the purification of beings. Now, this is the only way for the purification of beings. That means when mindfulness is practiced, it will lead to the purification of beings. And purification of beings means purification of the mind of beings, not the physical body. So for the purification of physical body, you don't need to practice mindfulness meditation. So here purification means purification of mind. So in order to purify the mind of unwholesome mental states, we practice mindfulness. So this is one benefit we can get from the practice of mindfulness. Mind is said to be purified when there are no unwholesome mental states in the mind. Now, attachment, greed, hate, anger, delusion, pride, jealousy, and so on, they are all called unwholesome mental states. So they contaminate the mind. So long as they are in the mind is said to be impure. But by the practice of mindfulness, when one is able to prevent them from arising in the mind or entering the mind, then the mind is said to be pure. So for the purification of the mind, we practice mindfulness. Now the second benefit Buddha stated was overcoming of sorrow and lamentation. So if we want to overcome sorrow and lamentation, we must practice mindfulness. Here, sorrow means just sorrow, and lamentation means crying aloud. So when people are sorry, they may just be sorry, or they may cry, and they may say some things when they are crying, and so that is called lamentation. Both sorrow and lamentation can be overcome by the practice of mindfulness. The mindfulness practice is to treat with mindfulness every object that arises in the mind. Now, when there is sorrow, we can practice mindfulness of that sorrow, or we can take that sorrow as the object of our attention, and we try to pay attention to it or to make mental notes of it. And by that way, sorrow will disappear. It is important that when you have sorrow and want to overcome it, then you take sorrow itself as the object of your attention and not because of sorrow. Now, it is important that we understand the cause of sorrow and sorrow itself. So long as we take the cause of sorrow as object, sorrow will increase. But once you turn your mind to sorrow itself, at that moment, the cause of sorrow disappears from your mind. And so when the cause disappears, the result, which is sorrow, must also disappear. So this is the mindfulness method to deal with not only sorrow, but other undesirable mental states. And the third benefit is the disappearance of pain and grief. Now, pain here means physical pain, and grief means mental pain. Now here, by the practice of mindfulness, physical pain may not disappear. But by the practice of mindfulness, you will understand pain more clearly, and you will see that pain also is impermanent, it comes and goes. And so when you realize the impermanence of pain, you are able to live with it. You are able to accept it. So it will no longer give you much trouble. So although physical pain may not disappear, if you practice mindfulness, you will be able to live with pain. And grief is mental pain. Mental pain means grief, disappointment, discouragement, and fear, and many other mental states. So, grief can be overcome, or grief can disappear by the practice of mindfulness. It is more or less the same as dealing with sorrow. So when there is grief, when there is mental pain, you try to be mindful of that pain, it's mental pain itself. And when your concentration becomes strong, then you will be able to overcome it, and it will disappear. So by the practice of mindfulness, physical pain may or may not disappear, but grief or mental pain will surely disappear. And the next benefit is reaching the noble path. Now, the word path should be understood correctly. Here, it is written with a capital P. In Pali, it is called Magga. Magga arises at the moment of enlightenment. Suppose a person is practicing Vipassana meditation, and he will go through different stages of Vipassana meditation one by one. And when his Vipassana has become mature, then a time will come when a type of consciousness arises in his mind. And that type of consciousness he has never experienced before. And that type of consciousness can eradicate the mental defilements once and for all. So that consciousness is called path consciousness. And to reach that consciousness, or to have that consciousness arise in one's mind, then one needs to practice mindfulness. So the practice of mindfulness will ultimately lead the practitioner to reaching the noble path. The last man, the last benefit is the realization of Nibbana. So when path or magga consciousness arises, it takes Nibbana as object. So Nibbana is the extinction of mental defilements and the extinction of suffering. So path consciousness arises taking Nibbana as object. So to take Nibbana as object is called realization of Nibbana. So Buddha pointed out the benefits that we will get if we practice mindfulness meditation. Now, these five benefits are actually just one: purification of mind. So when mind is totally pure, there can be no sorrow or lamentation, and there can be no grief. And when mind is totally pure, it reaches a stage of path consciousness. And when path consciousness arises, it takes Nibbana as object, and at that moment, the mind is totally pure again. So the benefit we will get from the practice of foundations of mindfulness is just total purification of mind. And what is this only way? Buddha said this is the four foundations of mindfulness. So the four foundations of mindfulness, or the practice of mindfulness, is the only way to achieve purification of mind and so on. And what are the four? Here in this teaching, because in this teaching means in the dispensation of the Buddha. A bhikkhu dwells contemplating the body, and the body ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful, removing covetousness and grief in the world. And this is the first foundation of mindfulness, and the others are second, third, and fourth. So the four foundations of mindfulness are described here by way of person or by way of a monk practicing it. So the first foundation of mindfulness is contemplating the body in the body. Now, the word contemplating is the translation of the Pali word anupassana. Anupassana means repeatedly seeing, repeatedly observing. So the English word contemplating may mean some other thing, but here contemplating means watching it repeatedly, seeing it repeatedly. And contemplating the body in the body means contemplating the body in the body and not contemplating the feeling in the body and so on. So the word body is repeated here to show that the contemplation must be precise. The body in the body and not feeling in the body, consciousness in the body and so on. The word body here does not necessarily mean the physical body only, or the whole physical body only. The body here means a group, a mass of different things. Now, if you go to the details in the discourse, you will find that the breathing in and breathing out are called body, and postures of the body are called body, and so on. So by the word body here, we must understand the group of or the combination of different parts, not necessarily the whole physical body. So when you are mindful of the breath, you are practicing the contemplation of the body in the body. And when we practice, Buddha taught that we must be ardent, clearly comprehending and mindful. So by these words, Buddha showed us the components of the practice. So when we practice mindfulness, we must have these components arise in our mind. So the first component is described by the word ardent. Now that means the bhikkhu or the yogi makes effort. So by ardent, Buddha meant that we must make effort to be mindful. Without effort, we cannot be mindful. And in the commentaries, it is explained that the effort has the ability to dry up or to heat up the mental defilements. So that means when there is effort, when we make effort, we can drive away or we can burn the mental defilements. Now, the Pali word for this English word is atapi. And atapi comes from the word atapa, which means heat. So, a person who has heat is called atapi, and heat here means effort. So, the effort has the ability to heat or to burn the mental defilements. When you read the passage in Pali, you can feel the meaning of the word atapi as heating up the mental defilements. But in the English translation, you cannot get that kind of meaning. The first component Buddha mentioned here is effort or making effort. And the second is clearly comprehending. So a yogi, when he practices mindfulness, here mindfulness of the body, he must clearly comprehend the body. He must clearly see the body. That means he must see correctly. And clear comprehension here means not just seeing or understanding, but understanding that there are just the parts of the body, there are just the mind that is aware of the body, and there is the body, and there are only these two things going on at every moment, and there is nothing which we can call a soul or a self or atta in this body. So clearly comprehending means seeing the things correctly, seeing that they are just the manifestation of the different aspects of the mind and body, and there is nothing apart from mind and body which we can call an agent or a person or a soul or a self. So understanding that way is called clear comprehension. So that will come only after some time of meditation. It will not come at the very beginning of the practice, but with practice, a yogi will be able to see in this way that there is nothing we can call a person or a soul or self apart from the mind and matter that are functioning at the moment. When you try to be mindful of the breath, and when you see that there are the breath and the mind that is mindful of the breath and nothing more, then you are set to have clear comprehension. And the third component Buddha mentioned is mindfulness. So a yogi practices mindfulness, and mindfulness means full awareness of the object, not a simple awareness, not a superficial awareness, but a deep going awareness. And that full awareness of the object is what we call mindfulness. Now, if you look at this sentence, you will find that the first is effort, and the second is understanding, and the third is mindfulness. Sometimes we cannot follow the order of the words in the discourse, because from the practical point of view, mindfulness must come after ardent. You make effort and you are mindful. And your mindfulness will improve with practice, and only after some practice, only after your mindfulness has become firm and mature, that you will see things clearly, or that clear comprehension can come. So although the order of the words here is the effort first, understanding second, and mindfulness third, in practice we must understand that effort first, and then there is mindfulness, and third, clear comprehension. There is a statement in the commentaries which says, the order of the words is one thing, and the order of the meaning is another. So that means sometimes we do not follow the order of words, but we follow the order of the meaning or order of what actually happens. So here we must understand that first there is effort, and then mindfulness, and then clear comprehension. And here, as this sentence stands, there is one component missing. When you practice mindfulness, your mind will become concentrated. Only when your mind is concentrated can you see clearly, can you have clear comprehension. So concentration is also an important component in the practice. But Buddha did not mention concentration here, so the sub-commentary explains that by mindfulness we must also take concentration. So following the sub-commentary, we get four components here: effort, mindfulness, concentration, and understanding. Now there is one more component not mentioned here, and that is faith or confidence. Now we need to have confidence in the teachings of the Buddha. We need to have confidence in the practice, and we need to have confidence in ourselves. If we do not have confidence, if we do not have devotion towards the Buddha, we will not practice at all. So, although confidence is not functioning actively when we practice mindfulness, it is still in the background. So, with confidence, we get five components. So, confidence, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and understanding. And these are the five that are called controlling faculties. By these words, ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful, Buddha showed us the components of the practice. And by the next expression, removing covetousness and grief in the world, Buddha showed us the mental state to be abandoned. For by the words removing covetousness and grief in the world, Buddha showed us what is removed, what are removed, or what are abandoned by the practice of mindfulness. Or when we practice mindfulness, we remove, we abandon, or we prevent covetousness and grief from arising in our minds. You don't have to make special effort to remove covetousness and grief. When you are mindful, when your mind is concentrated, and when you see things clearly, then you are at the same time removing, that means preventing, covetousness and grief to arise in your mind. So at every moment of your practice, at every moment of mindfulness, at every moment of clear comprehension, you are removing the covetousness and grief. Now, the original words for covetousness and grief are abhijja and domanasa. Now, the word abhijja, translated here as covetousness, primarily means the desire to possess something that other people possess. Suppose a person has a new car, then if another person wants to get that new car for his own, then he is said to have abhijja or covetousness. So abhijja in this sense is not just attachment or desire or craving, but it is the desire to possess the possessions of other people. Say you have a good car and I want to get that car for myself, and that is covetousness. But here in this sentence, covetousness or abhijja is used not in this narrow sense. It means just attachment or craving or desire. By the word grief also, you must understand not just grief, but ill will, hate, anger, disappointment, depression, discouragement, and so on. Now, there are five mental hindrances, and among these five, these two are included: covetousness and grief, or attachment and ill will. And these two are the more powerful hindrances than the other three. And so when these two are mentioned, we must understand that the others are also mentioned. So by the words removing covetousness and grief in the world really means removing all the five mental hindrances. So as you practice mindfulness, you remove these mental hindrances. So when the mental hindrances are removed, you get concentration. So when you get concentration, you see things clearly. Now, in this sentence, the translation removing is important, because in many other translations, they said having removed or having abandoned or having overcome. But the translating the Pali word with having is not correct here, because if we say having removed covetousness and grief, it will mean that we must first remove covetousness and grief and then practice mindfulness. But actually, we practice mindfulness to get rid of or to remove covetousness and grief. If we have already removed covetousness and grief, we don't need to practice mindfulness. We already have achieved our goal. So the Pali word here, used here, although it can mean having, say, removed or whatever, here it does not have that sense. So here it means that the removing and being mindful occur at the same time. So while he is mindful, he is removing covetousness and grief. So he doesn't have to make a special effort to remove covetousness and grief. As he go along, he is removing covetousness and grief. and not after removing covetousness and greed, but he removed the covetousness and greed as he go along with his practice of mindfulness. So by this short statement, Buddha taught us what to do when we practice mindfulness meditation, and what mental states we can remove or we can prevent as we go along the practice of mindfulness. Okay, I thought I could finish explaining the four foundations of mindfulness today, but as it is, we will have to wait until tomorrow for the explanation of the foundations of mindfulness.
Sa-ra-vi, sa-ra-vi, sa-ra-vi.